Tasneem Esop is currently the Executive Director of Climate Action Network International, and she's also serving as a second term for the Commissioner, as a Commissioner in the National Planning Commission in South Africa, appointed by the President, and is very active on climate and just transition issues. I know Tasneem well because she used to be my former colleague at WWF, and it's just a real pleasure to have her back here. So Tasneem, if I may ask you to then proceed with your inputs.
Thanks very much, and Salim, and thank you very much to Professor Lopez for his intervention. One, I think we must challenge our concept of development. So when we're talking about a climate change and development nexus, I think, of course, we know that the concept of development is a contested concept in itself. And there are assumptions in very broadly within the African continent, and especially amongst the decision makers, that development is all about economic growth. And I think this is an area, Salim, that we'd probably need to be challenging. You know, if we view development as, I suppose, its original intention, and that is the kind of social change that we would want to bring about in societies to ensure human well-being, then from that perspective, we have many lessons and, of course, the opportunities for what the climate crisis presents. So I want to assert, and I think to a large extent this, you know, you correctly in your opening remarks identified the fact that there's still a very polarized view about climate change as a burden, as the antithesis to development, etc. But I think to a large extent, there's a growing consensus that in fact that is not the case. And so there is a recognition more broadly, whether that translates into the kind of policy and practice to address this at domestic levels is another issue. But for sure, we know now that we cannot address climate change without a developmental approach. And we cannot have development without addressing climate change. And I think Professor Lopez very clearly identified, the vulnerabilities that we have in our economies and in our societies to the climate crisis specifically, and of course, more broadly to crises in general. And so just like the professor did, I'd really like to use this current opportunity, I mean, this current crisis that we're experiencing, COVID-19, as an opportunity to draw out lessons for the climate crisis. Because I think it would be a miss of us to actually not draw those linkages in such a conversation. So just these are my personal observations. I mean, we all caught in, you know, analysis of this crisis and what it means for our future, etc. But I think that there are some very important and sharp lessons that we can learn from this COVID crisis. And so this is what I would like to suggest. Of course, firstly, the health, safety, and well-being of our people matter. And especially those who are on the front lines, frontline workers, frontline communities, and those who are vulnerable, of course, to the pandemic and more broadly crises. Secondly, science matters. Thirdly, leadership matters. Fourth, solidarity matters, and that includes local solidarity and global solidarity. And within that, of course, we need to start talking about multilateralism, the threats to multilateralism that we are witnessing now, and also whether the current form of multilateralism is still applicable. The fifth lesson, of course, is that of transparent, inclusive, and democratic governance matter. Robust and resilient systems matter. Food, water, and energy security matter. And I think Professor Lopez has already spoken to that. Active citizenry matters. Equity and justice matters. And investment matters. And so, if we look at these lessons, and they are good and bad features that we're experiencing in all of those in this current crisis, all of these issues that matter for the COVID crisis matter for the climate crisis as well. And so when we deal with the nexus between climate change and development, you know, the issue for the African continent particularly has to be fundamentally about dealing with the vulnerabilities. And our biggest challenge on this continent, as we know, is poverty and inequality. So any work that we do to address climate change, whether it's the work that we do to reduce the emissions causing climate change, or whether it's dealing with our climate impacts and the risks around that, we have to put poverty and inequality at the center. And in doing so, you're fundamentally already dealing with development and the developmental challenges that we have. And what I'd like to really pivot towards now was, I suppose, the debates or the polarized views around this has landed more sharply in the scientific domain, is the publication of the IPCC 1.5 degree report. That report, in my view, was a game changer. Because unlike other scientific reports that the IPCC presented, this report included social science and broader than just, you know, the kind of science around emissions, etc. And so I'd like to forefront what the IPCC report actually has contributed towards this current debate, the climate and development nexus. I think for too long, many of us working in the climate space and even in the climate movements have focused our attention very strongly on, you know, the reduction of carbon. And so carbon was the central feature of what we did on climate change. And what we're starting to recognize, of course, and with many of us have for many years before this, but more and more there's a growing recognition that in fact what we're needing to look at is what is called upon us now in the 1.5 report, and that is to radically transform our economies and our societies. That's what the scientists are calling for. I mean, I know, Salim, we had big debates about the word radical in the past, and scientists are telling us this is what we need, radical transformation of our economies, of our systems. And this has to happen, in fact, within this decade. So by 2030, we are supposed to have these transformations happen, and we know that any radical transformation that takes place, if it is not done in a manner that serves justice as well and is fair and equitable, we will have problems. So again, another feature of any transformation that we need on the continent has to feature, in addition to poverty and equality, the concept of justice. I'm hoping that the participants in this webinar will have read the IPCC report, but if they haven't, then it would be really good for them to particularly go to section D of this report. Many people are very focused on what we need to do in terms of targets and reduction of emissions, but section D provides powerful guidance for what we need to do to address this climate challenge that fundamentally forefronts the issues of development. So, for example, I mean, where have we ever heard that, you know, scientists dealing with climate would talk about issues of social justice and equity as an example? And so they basically highlight the fact that these are core aspects for any climate resilient pathways that aim to limit global warming to 1.5. And of course, and within the use of these social justice and equity interventions, this will help us also address the trade-offs that are going to be really difficult for us on the African continent, particularly when we have to make those very difficult decisions about which path, which trajectory we follow. So Scientists are saying social justice and equity are critical for us to address climate change. Another aspect they talk about, of course, is the issue of redistributive policies. Now, you know, again, we've not heard scientists talk about these things in IPCC reports before. And so, I mean, I've got a whole set of very specific guidelines that the scientists of the IPCC have actually presented to us in that report. And I think that is a really useful starting point in the discussion about the nexus between climate change and development, because it is pretty clear in terms of what are the options available, especially in vulnerable regions like the African continent, to be looking at. And I think, you know, it recognizes the fact that we have to have high levels of participation, that we have to look at indigenous knowledge, et cetera, et cetera. So we have something to turn to as a guide by scientists through the IPCC 1.5 report. And I would encourage everyone to actually take a look at that. So, what does this lead us to now in terms of the opportunities going forward? I think, as Professor Lopez has already indicated as well, our biggest opportunity right now has to be the fact that COVID-19 and the government's response to COVID-19 through recovery packages or recovery plans is one of the most important immediate opportunities for us to change things, to shift the trajectory, to be able to look at alternative development patterns, as the professor spoke about, or pathways, etc. You know, there's a big global slogan now around these recovery packages in, well, the movements and even in the UN, called Build Back Better. And I think that that building back better has to be just. So we talk about a just recovery in the movements, and it has to be sustainable or green or whatever language you want to use, so that we can connect these different crises in a way that builds the kind of societal resilience and economic resilience that we would need going forward, not just to deal with pandemics, but to deal with multiple crises that act as cumulative impacts over time. So that kind of resilience through a building back better recovery plan for Africa, for individual nations, but also for the continent, is going to be really important. One of the important things that we cannot afford to do right now is to invest in sectors or infrastructure that will essentially lock in what caused crisis in the first place as well. So it's very good to hear from Professor Lopez that, in fact, the African continent, in terms of its fossil fuel dependence and the fossil fuel economic dependence, is not as high as the rest of the country. And of course, we will feel the impacts of what has happened to oil prices, etc. But certainly, you know, we have an opportunity to shift away from our dependence on that commodity. And so, which brings me to the second area, and which of course should be built into the recovery plans as well, and that is the issue of energy security and energy access on the continent. And now, it's a pity that Hussein is not on the call right now, because he was one of the kind of founding thinkers of this African Renewable Energy Initiative. It was a homegrown African initiative. It went through the African Union. It was an amazing framework for renewable energy on the continent, and included elements which to now has actually been, I think, not forefronted as importantly as the rest of that initiative. And, you know, it really spoke to the possibility, the opportunities to do community-based renewable energy generation. and these can be community owned as well. And so I think in addition to all, you know, what we've ended up doing is, of course, looking at, as we usually do, big infrastructure, big developments, and really, you know, to a large extent, foreign funded investments in renewable energies on the continent. And we've really missed an important opportunity to look at our homegrown solutions that will address multiple objectives, including poverty and inequality. So the idea of decentralized, community-based or socially owned renewables is a real opportunity for the continent, because, as you know, Salim, I've said this for a very long time, I think that the potential for renewable energy as a technology to be democratic is a very real opportunity. So it is, the technology is easily decentralized, you know, poor communities in rural areas, even the urban poor, etc., can become not just consumers of energy, but producers of energy as well, which is a deeply empowering way to look at it. So I think on the energy front, to deal with energy access, in turn to deal with poverty, is a really big opportunity for us. And I think we would need to reimagine, if the Africa Renewable Energy Initiative is not in the forefront, that we'll need to fight to get that back. But we also need to then just go back to the drawing board and reimagine how we produce energy on our continent while delivering on our developmental objectives of dealing with poverty and inequality. The other opportunities, of course, is around the agricultural sector, and the professor's already spoken to our vulnerabilities in supply chains, etc. And again, if we needing to look at what we want, learning the lessons out of this crisis, what we want in the future, and if it is going to be something that addresses human well-being, then our traditional methods of agriculture would also need to be reviewed. And as you know, there's a big movement towards agroecology, which respects food sovereignty, respects nature, etc. And so those methods of agriculture in the future, it would be something that we would need to look at as well. I know that, Salim, you've spoken about smart climate smart agriculture, but we should also be debating what that concept of climate smart agriculture has been, and especially from within the status quo as well. So I'm going to end off by saying that, and supporting what Professor also said, we have a very small window of opportunity, I might add, but a window of opportunity nonetheless, to not only reimagine a future for Africa, but actually build that future, a new future for Africa, where we do not mimic past and failed economic models and development models, that we can actually provide leadership as the African continent and show in a very practical way that development can be done differently. So be the leader in the world for alternative development and economic models. That, I think, is the opportunity that we have right now. It has to happen, well, immediately while we're planning all these recovery interventions, but also it needs to be laying the basis for our ability to address multiple crises and our ability to be resilient as communities, as peoples first, as economies into the future. And in doing so, of course, that then helps with laying the basis very strongly for addressing the climate change as one of the most critical global challenges that we are facing today, over and above this immediate pandemic that we have to address very seriously right now. So I'll leave it there, Salim. Thank you very much.
Thank you for giving a very comprehensive view around some of the debates around climate change, and particularly the relevance of the IPCC report.
So just in terms of people's voice, people's power on the African continent, I think, you know, if ever there was a continent that has a very rich, rich, rich history about people's power it would be ours. And so not only in South Africa, but in the rest of the continent, struggles against slavery, colonialism, apartheid in South Africa, etc., was built off people's power. And so we should also recognize that important role that many peoples have played in the continent. And so we should not also forget to learn the lessons from that. And we in South Africa alone have a very rich history of how we won the struggle against apartheid and won our freedom. So, you know, it means being organized. And so get involved in organization. There are many organizations in this country or the rest of the continent where whether you're young or old, you are being organized. There are movements on this continent. My own organization has many, you know, in the network, we have members in most countries on the continent. There are others like Africa Rising. There's the Climate Justice Network. There's the Pan-African Climate Justice Network, etc. So I think my first call to you would be to find out more about these organizations, these movements, and get involved. Or get involved in any local community organization. Many community organizations are working during this current crisis. If you connect with that and then link that to the wider issues that we're discussing, for example, that would be also important, because many times climate change and dealing with it seems to be too far away and not recognized as an immediate and present danger. And so making the connections between these crises are going to be important, and especially forefronting poverty, inequality, and justice. So yes, my suggestion and advice would be get involved, get into organizations, or get organized, and then use your power. So, you know, we have different platforms now to express our viewpoints, you know, whether it's social media platforms during this current crisis, whether it's mobilization, campaigning, etc. We have to get our voices heard as well. So not just, you know, having the voice that's going to be making critical demands, but also to provide solutions. And so I want to come to the question that dealt with, are there any proposed plans and solutions that's being recommended for these recovery packages? And there's been, in fact, a really important bit of work driven by movements on the African continent, which actually presents these alternatives to the recovery plans for Africa. And I am not sure how I could share that, but if I share it with the organizers of this webinar, we can share the link to that document as well after. So that would be an important, you know, first widely consulted presentation of alternative plans for the recovery. And I know that a number of groups are also looking at this in South Africa itself. You know, how do we get this to government? Again, by just continuously working hard at the advocacy, pushing for this to be taken into serious consideration. Salim, I'm going to end off with a response to the just transition thing. And here I also talk in my capacity as leading the work on the just transition in the Planning Commission in South Africa. So, of course, it is challenging. You know, we are a coal-dependent country. We have to ensure workers' security as well. And there will be loss of jobs. But what we have decided to do is to take an economy-wide approach to the just transition, because I don't know what Channing's going to say, but the assumption that all the jobs lost in the coal sector will be absorbed into the renewable energy sector is actually not true. It's not possible. And I mean, just in terms of geography and in terms of the absorption rates for that sector. And that's why we need to have an economy-wide approach to the just transition, so that we can look at where, which other sectors, which new sectors in the economy can absorb these job losses. So yes, the important thing about dealing with phasing out of coal in this country, would have to be through a just transition process. It has to have workers at the table. It has to have impacted communities at the table. It's not a decision that only ESCOM or government can make. So that's the point about the just transition. But I do also want to say, which is often missed, and this is something we learnt from our social dialogue process throughout the country. We're very focused on the job losses in the coal industry, and rightly so. But what we encountered in our engagements in different provinces was that there's an invisible job loss due to climate impacts that is not being spoken about. So, for example, when the drought impacted many provinces in South Africa, we lost numbers of farm worker jobs. Very vulnerable workers. They don't have a very strong political voice, I suppose, in the country. And so those job losses went ahead without big newspaper headlines about it. And so on the flip side of the kind of losses we will face because we have to take mitigation action, we also have to look at the justice for those who are in sectors, working in sectors who are being impacted on by climate change. Those losses were due to climate change impacts, droughts, etc. So, and it's not just the agricultural sector. We know the tourism sector, etc., was hit hard during that. So when we deal with the just transition and the rights of workers and the security of workers, it would be really important to have a much wider view on all of this and ensure that, in fact, justice is served to all those who are going to be impacted on by climate change. And so the whole notion of leaving no one behind is going to be important in that.
I have a question, Tasneem, because we, in the last 15 minutes, if I can ask each of the speakers to make rounding off comments, and Tasneem, if you could go first, it's really to understand two things. The one is from your side, Tasneem, once you respond to the infrastructure question. You know, I'm curious about the Paris Agreement and where it's going to go, and the geopolitics of that. And I think, do we need to work with the Paris Agreement, and do we have to work outside of the Paris Agreement? The second thing is really around how do we activate real recovery around the climate development nexus on the African continent in a coordinated way? Because I think acting collectively gives us strength. We can't act individually by each country. And how do we use the current momentum for inter-regional sort of cooperation around the health issues to actually build a platform for that kind of cooperation for the African continent? And the third part is really around how do we relate geopolitically, Carlos, Channing, and Tasneem, with other geopolitical partners like China? We haven't talked about China's role and the level of debt it actually owns on the African continent. The European Union is talking about the Green New Deal. How do we, you know, take advantage of that? And then we've got North America and the US and so on. And there's, of course, a lot of South-South relationships, which we haven't talked about. So I'm just curious, in your last 5 minutes, if you can just cast your views on that, and then we'll try to round off and conclude this session. Thank you. Tasneem, you can go first.
Thank you very much, Salim. So I also want to take a bit of a stab at the question about reimagined infrastructure. And I really want to bring it back to almost the basics, right? So as we know, all of us, this current pandemic has actually just made visible all the inequities that exist in our society, and particularly in South Africa, we're very aware of that. And so, for example, if we want to reimagine what that future looks like, as I said in my intervention, I think that for us, building robust and resilient economies and societies would have to be the bedrock of how we recover. And part of that, recovery has to be fronting and centering poverty and inequality. So what then would a reimagined infrastructure look like? For one, we know that our firstly, broadly, spatial planning in this country. We've been speaking about this forever. It's been in all kinds of policies of government. You know, we have to redress the apartheid spatial planning that still remains a very strong legacy in our country, right? So, and within that, how we plan spaces, urban, etc., becomes really important. And within that, how do we address housing and housing infrastructure and spaces and, you know, informal settlements into the future? So the idea that you can have social distancing or physical distancing in this kind of spatial, urban housing settlements is impossible. And it's not just the pandemic. We know that one of the impacts of climate change is a regular fire. And Cape Town is well known for this. And the hardest hit, every time we have a fire season, are those living in informal settlements. So again, a reimagined infrastructure plan in the country would not be about big infrastructure, as I said, which we love, but actually looking at the basics again. How do we build up the social infrastructure that at the same time addresses poverty and inequality and builds resilience for climate and other crises? And that's really important. It's the social infrastructure, our schools, our clinics, our housing. All of these are critical infrastructure that I think needs to be part of a reimagined and prioritized infrastructure program in the country, and not just, as I said, the kind of big stuff that we love doing. And so, for me, the issue of understanding that if you address those social infrastructure and you address poverty, you actually, and this is in line with what the IPCC says itself in its fourth assessment report already, that those most vulnerable are the poor, those living in poverty. So if you address that vulnerability, you're addressing the resilience and you're reducing the risk. So for me, any reimagined infrastructure program has to be addressing the social infrastructure needs of the poor in this country. So that's my point about reimagined infrastructure. I'm not one for, and included in that is the point I made about energy. And again, it's not these big, you know, the solar thermal plants that we want to have and big wind farms, but it can be, you know, democratic, decentralized, community-owned options that we need to explore. All right, so on the Paris Agreement, very challenging because, of course, you know, the Paris Agreement, we're supposed to have a COP at the end of the year, which we're not going to be having. And, of course, so all the timelines and I suppose the roadmaps linked to those timelines have been thrown off a little bit. One of the big pieces, of course, has been the need for all countries to submit their enhanced NDCs by COP26, which was going to be in November. Well, the only African country, and in fact, we must be extremely proud because it is also one of the few countries that have submitted an enhanced NDC was Rwanda, and really an ambitious NDC for Rwanda. South Africa hasn't submitted an enhanced NDC. And what we are really concerned about, and be really good to hear from Saini about the impact on the, you know, in countries in Africa, is that big, big emitters are going to use this current crisis as an excuse not to also continue the work that needs to actually continue in terms of getting ambitious climate action. So, you know, and once that starts happening, this kind of lack of trust, the kind of bad faith, the backpedaling, will start emerging. And one of the important other agenda items for this year was going to be this minuscule 100 billion a year finance that developed countries had to provide. And so we won't necessarily know to what extent that obligation has been fulfilled. And again, if that's not clear, this kind of trust-building exercise that multilateralism depends on will also just weaken the overall Paris Agreement. And what we are offering as civil society and proposing is that even if we're not having a COP, a physical COP in November, that we actually have a massive accountability moment. And the movements will call for that and work towards that, where governments are going to be asked about their NDCs and progress, and particularly the finance piece, and hold governments accountable to that. I still think it's important. Look, when the Paris Agreement was adopted, I come from civil society. We had real criticisms about the level of ambition, the kind of volunteerism related to that agreement, etc. But it's the only global agreement that we have. And of course, the US has not. They're leaving the Paris, they've left the Paris Agreement, etc. But still, it's the only global agreement we have. And I think we need to use the architecture that was put into that agreement to constantly strengthen that agreement. So it's not cast in concrete. There are processes of stock taking, etc., where we can continuously, I think, and we should be strengthening that Paris Agreement. I think that the issues of the geopolitics, I mean, you know, of course, it's going to impact on Africa itself. I think that in the context of that very inward-looking shifts, especially in many countries who have right-wing autocratic governments right now, it is up to us to, as Africa, to be the flag bearer for interregional cooperation, for multilateralism, for solidarity, for the continued South-South relationships that we have. And we must really be that flag bearer, because I think that Africa is one of the most vulnerable to all kinds of crises, continents. And it is, as I said, and I think Professor Lopez also indicated, we have this opportunity now to provide leadership. Everything has been disrupted. In this moment, I think it was Churchill or some other person who said, do not let a good crisis go to waste. This is our time. And I think we really do have the ability and capability to provide leadership on all of these fronts. New development models, providing leadership on multilateralism and solidarity, ensuring that kind of democratic and just institutional infrastructure exists for all of us to participate in and ensure, of course, given the history of our own continent and our struggles, that people, their voices, their movements are constantly respected, supported, and encouraged. I'll leave it at this, Alex.